From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Todd Phillips, director and co-writer of the film Joker, which won Golden Globes for Best Actor in a Movie Drama for Joaquin Phoenix and Best Original Score. The movie is a sort of origin story for the villain in the Batman series, but Joker is not a comic book movie.
It really started as an experiment, so to speak, is like, well, you know, maybe you could get one of those kind of deep dive character study movies done nowadays in the studio system if you, I guess, disguise it as a comic book film.
Also, we talk with Andrea Bernstein, author of the new book American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. Bernstein also co-hosts the podcast Trump Inc. And John Powers reviews the new HBO series The Outsider, based on a suspense novel by Stephen King. First news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
Is it just me, or is it getting crazier out there?
The city is going crazy, and the main character is becoming increasingly unhinged in the movie Joker, which won 2 Golden Globes for Best Actor in a Movie Drama for Joaquin Phoenix and Best Original Score. The movie just came out on DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K. Joker was produced, directed, and co-written by our guest Todd Phillips, who also directed the Hangover films. Joker is an origin story, sort of, for the villain in the Batman comics and movies. But the movie isn't a comic book story. It's set in Gotham City in 1981, but Gotham looks very much like Manhattan in 1981. The main character, Arthur Fleck, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is a troubled man with a history of serious mental health problems. It's Arthur's dream to be a stand-up comic. At the beginning of the film, Arthur dresses in a clown costume and makeup because he works for an agency that rents out clowns for parties and occasions. One night on the subway, he's attacked by 3 young white men in suits. He defends himself with a gun and kills them. There's so much crime in the city and people are feeling so victimized that Arthur becomes a hero to a lot of angry people. And those people start wearing clown masks in tribute to him. Meanwhile, the city is so broke, it's cutting social services. And for Arthur, that means he's forced off his meds because his assistance has been cut. The deterioration of the city and of Arthur's mental health feed off each other in a disastrous way. Todd Phillips, welcome back to Fresh Air. Joker has really divided audiences and critics, but it's done fantastically at the box office. I'm one of the people who thinks this is a terrific film and a very serious film. You've said that you made the character Joker in order to make a serious movie that's kind of about a comic book character so you could get a big budget. It was, you said, a way to sneak a real movie into the studio system under the guise of a comic book film. Tell us more about that.
I started to think that films that I grew up loving, that how hard it is to get those movies made nowadays, and how, not just because studios don't want to make them, people don't want to show up to them necessarily. And I started looking around at the state of the movie business about what people are showing up to. Clearly, you know, superhero films have taken over. The comic book genre didn't even exist when I was younger, right? There were horror movies, comedies, romantic comedies, dramas, but now, you know, the comic book movie is its own genre. And when you're making a film, you know, whether it's good or bad, it takes you 2 to 3 years, and it's disappointing when audiences don't show up. And so it, to me, it was a way of kind of wrapping the movie in a way of cutting through the fog, so to speak. You know, nowadays with Netflix and all the content that's out there, films really have to kind of cut through all the noise to get people to show up to the theaters. So it really started as an experiment, so to speak, is like, well, you know, maybe you could get one of those kind of deep dive character study movies done nowadays in the studio system if you, I guess, disguise it as a comic book film. Not that it was a trick we were playing. It was just something of, boy, you know, you could do a character study if it was about one of those characters. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does to me. So Joker is always described as an origin story for the character of the Joker. But, you know, the movie's called Joker, not The Joker. So it seems to me like you're hedging a little bit. It's like, yeah, he's Joker. He's not necessarily The Joker.
Well, I mean, I think ambiguity is a fun part of this film, and I think films in general. And we do like putting little things out there. If you actually see the screenplay we wrote on the cover, it says Joker, and then under it, it says an origin, not the origin. And it's not like hedging our bets as much as it is saying, you know, Joker, I don't know how much you know about the character, but he's famous for not having an origin story. He's famous for saying in one of the comic books, or a Killing Joke, I think, where he says, I prefer my past to be multiple choice. We knew we were going to have some pushback from, or we thought we were going to have some pushback from comic book fans saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, this is sacrilegious, so to speak. You can't give an origin to Joker. That's part of the fun thing about Joker.
So the film is set in the early 80s in Gotham, which has been to be kind of like New York in the early 80s. You were, I think, 10 or 11 in 1981. In the film, there's like a garbage strike. There's tons of garbage piling up around the city. Super rats have infested the city. There's cuts in social services, unemployment, anger, hostility. The mayor's declared a state of emergency. What's your connection to 1981 and Manhattan, and also to the decay and despair and the crime and poverty and garbage and chaos that you associate with Gotham in your
movie? Well, I mean, my connection to it is, you know, having grown up in New York. I wasn't in Manhattan when I was 10 or 11. At that point, we had moved to Long Island, but my mother worked in the city, and oftentimes I'd go in with her to work when I had a school day off, and we didn't have a babysitter, because, you know, I grew up with a single mom and two older sisters, so oftentimes I would go with my mom. And I do remember the city back at that time and it feeling like kind of a broken down city on the brink. And to us, it felt like, when I say us, Scott Silver and I, who wrote the script, it felt like the right setting for creating a character like Arthur Fleck / Joker. We wanted that kind of hopeless feeling. We wanted everything to be kind of coming down on Arthur, the mounds of garbage everywhere. I mean, these are obviously, it was based on a real time in New York. There were real garbage strikes in New York. New York's always had rat problems. I remember seeing the cover of the New York Post once saying super rats. So, you know, you pick and choose and you take things from your past, and then, of course, you create new things and you build off of it.
Let's talk about your vision of Joker, the character of Arthur. He initially paints his face like a clown because he's employed by an agency that basically rents out clowns, right, like for your child's party or for like the hospital children's ward. But for reasons I won't explain, I don't want to give away too much stuff. You know, he loses his job, but he continues sometimes to paint his face. And he has serious mental health problems. There's a history of mental health problems in his family, and he's soon off his meds because he can no longer afford them, and the city can no longer help him because they're shutting down social services. And his mental health deteriorates as the movie goes on. Why did you want this Joker to have a mental health disorder? And
well,
is it a specific disorder that you've given him?
Well, it wasn't that we wanted him to necessarily have a mental health disorder. What really we wanted to do, and what really the whole MO of the film was, let's make a comic book film where we run everything through as realistic a lens as possible. So why does Joker have a white face and green hair? Well, in the comic books, he fell into a vat of acid. That didn't feel very real to us. If you fell into a vat of acid, I don't know that your skin would turn white and your hair would be green. So we came up, we sort of backwards engineered everything. The mental illness was also a thing of going, well, a little bit like, where does his laugh come from? And if you see the movie, you realize he has a condition. Joke, you know, the Joker character in the comic book world is famous for the green hair, the white face, the laugh. So we really just wanted to give everything real world reasons.
So the deteriorating mental health gives...
Well, that was, okay, so, you know, that's a different question, two parts. The first thing is we didn't ever really discuss specifically with Joaquin, when I say we again, me and Joaquin, didn't really discuss what... We didn't want to put a specific label on what his mental illness is outside of his affliction that gives him the laugh, which is something that's caused from head trauma early on in life, which is a real thing. You know, nowadays it's called PBA, pseudobulbar effect. But back then, I don't know that they even had that name for it. But it's a real condition. So we thought once we found that condition, you know, okay, that answers that. As far as the mental health thing, you know, we really wanted to make a movie that says something, a statement, if you will, on these modern times. Yes, it takes place in 1981 in a fictional city of Gotham, but we wrote it in 2017 in New York City. And oftentimes, you know, movies are mirrors and they reflect what's going on whenever they take place. And that was something Scott and I really was important to us, that we are addressing things that we feel or felt were going on in the world in 2016 and 17 as we were writing it. You know, we all know the big changes in this country that were happening then. I can tell you, when Obama was president, we wrote 3 Hangover movies. when everything changed, suddenly things felt darker. You know. Anyway, so the mental illness to us was a lot about, you know, what you hear about when social services get cut, what happens to these people. We really thought it was important to shine a light on the system. You know, I think, like a lot of people, the system's broken, and why not use a film to make a comment on that?
And in that sense, when he can't take his meds anymore because the system is broken, and there's a lot of damage that is done as a result, and not just to him.
Yeah, I mean, really, the real-world implications of these things, it just felt like a great thing to explore. If we're really going to, you know, turn the comic book genre upside down, or maybe that's too big a way of saying it, but if we're really going to dive into that sandbox, you know, let's do something, let's make something meaningful.
The Hangover movies that you're famous for are comedies. Mm-hmm. And Joker, although the main character sees himself as a comedian, this film is far from funny. It's a very grave movie. And you said that you made a drama in part because it's hard to make a comedy nowadays. It's hard to write comedy with woke culture. And, like, you know, comics are very afraid to offend, and you can't argue with 30 million people on Twitter. Had you gotten pushback for your comedies, or were you just thinking of other people who had?
No, in that quote of mine that I was really referring to very specifically maybe 10 or 11 things me and the writer were talking about that were in, let's say, old school or the Hangover films that you literally couldn't do nowadays, that I wouldn't do nowadays, by the way, and probably shouldn't. So it was more about that. It wasn't a statement about comedy in general.
I think you were really misinterpreted. If that's true, were really misinterpreted.
I know.
And I'm glad you set
the
record straight on that.
I know. And the problem is I don't have a Twitter account to set the record straight, so I just mm-hmm. ignore it and mm-hmm. just say, everything goes away.
Yeah, because it seemed like, you cannot be funny anymore because of woke culture, and that's apparently not what you intended to say.
Not at all. No, I was literally talking about 10 or 11 things we were going through in those movies that you just couldn't do nowadays. So it's not so much a statement on the state of comedy, Joker, you know, I actually, if you rewatch the Hangover movies, and I'm not suggesting you do this, but if you watch all 3 in a row, they get progressively darker. The more freedom we had, the bolder we got with sort of almost jumping genres and playing with the darkness a little bit. Hangover 2 is way darker than the first one, and the third one is barely a comedy intentionally. We almost jump genres in the film. So that's just a little bit where my tastes were headed. It's not so much a reaction to, you know, the state of comedy or a grand thing. But yeah, Joker is clearly much more a tragedy than a comedy. And in fact, a lot of the movie is about, you know, just that, about, you know, is his life a comedy or is it really a tragedy?
Joaquin Phoenix lost over 50 pounds for this role, like he kind of did in The Master. And when his shirt is off, He looks so undernourished, and you imagine he's like emotionally undernourished and spiritually undernourished, that he's undernourished in every way, like his bones jutting out. It's kind of like a metaphor for his whole existence. How did you feel watching him lose that much weight? It's not a healthy thing to do. I understand his desire to do it for the role, and it really is, it's very disturbing to see. It's very effective in the movie. But were you worried about his health when he was doing it, and did you feel very responsible?
Okay, so first I should say, he did not have any desire to do it. That was something I asked him to do.
Oh, really?
He came to me early. In the script, it was written, you know, that Arthur is, I don't know if we use these words, but malnourished and wolf-like in his appearance, you know, or coyote, I don't remember. But it was always really important to me that he was bone skinny. Joaquin came to me early on in those initial meetings when we were talking about doing the movie and said, you know, what do you think if it's the opposite? What do you think if he's sort of like heavy Joker, like, you know, just kind of, because, you know, he's on all these medications, and sometimes the side effects of medications is you gain weight. And I said, no, I really think he needs to sort of look hungry all the time, or as you said, just malnourished. And he was bummed because he knew how hard it was, because like you said, he'd done that before in The Master, he lost a bunch of weight. I was only concerned because he put it off for so long. He didn't really start losing weight until, I think, May or June, and we started shooting in September. And I kept saying, when do you start doing it? He's like, don't worry, I know how to do this, I've done it before. And so I was only concerned with the speed at which he did it, which really, he lost 52 pounds in 3 months, I think. And now I will also say, he had to lose 20, meaning even Joaquin would say he was 20 pounds overweight at that time for him. So, you know, the 20 were like, okay, good, now he's back to how he normally is. But then to lose those 30 was no joke.
Todd Phillips, thank you so much. It's really been great to have you back on the show. And congratulations on the success of the film. I mean, people are very passionate. People are divided about it. But it's provoked a lot of really interesting conversations. And for, it's a great piece of filmmaking.
It has definitely struck a nerve. And I really appreciate you having me on, Terry. It's a thrill.
Todd Phillips directed and co-wrote Joker, which is now out on DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K. My guest, Andrea Bernstein, is the author of the new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. She describes it as the story of two dynasties that have both benefited from and fueled a system of widening inequality and greater influence of money in politics, a tale of specific choices, theirs and the country's, about taxation, regulation, corruption, and campaign finance laws that brought us to where we are today. Bernstein also co-hosts the podcast Trump Inc., as in Trump Incorporated, which investigates who's profiting from the Trump administration and at what cost. It's a co-production of public radio station WNYC in New York and ProPublica. She's covered politics, money, power, and influence for the past 25 years. Andrea Bernstein, welcome back to Fresh Air. The Trump administration has been very anti-immigration, especially if the immigrants are Muslim or Mexican. One of his campaign promises was build the wall. Jared Kushner is now responsible for overseeing construction of the border wall. So let's talk about their immigrant roots and how their immigrant families got to America and built their fortune here. So let's start with Trump. So his grandfather, is it pronounced Friedrich?
Friedrich Trump.
Arrived in New York in 1885. This was only months after the Statue of Liberty arrived. Why did he leave Germany?
So he left Germany because of inheritance laws. He was not the oldest son, and he was only going to be able to inherit a small plot of land. And also, Germany was at war, and he didn't want to enter the army. So he came to America and got work immediately as a barber. He lived in New York City and decided he wanted to make more money. So he went west.
So he stops in Seattle first, opens a restaurant there, but he made his money in the Yukon, which is far north on the eastern border of Alaska. It's part of Canada. Why did he go to the Yukon?
So while he was living in Seattle, there was boatload of gold that arrived in Seattle, and it caused this frenzy. There was a sense that anybody could make their riches digging for gold.
This is during the gold rush era.
It was the gold rush era. It's actually sort of the end of the gold rush era. And so people streamed northward, and it was an incredibly arduous passage to this territory in the sort of was really Alaska then, or I guess Northwest Canada. And there was this stream of people going there, and they had to carry 1,000 pounds of goods with them to make sure that they would make the trip. So it was a really hard trip, and they had to eat horse meat along the way, and there were driving mosquitoes. But when they got there, they were looking for gold. Now, Friedrich Trump was not doing that. He was in the hospitality business. He ran a series of restaurants known as the Arctic Restaurant. And they sold all kinds of food and liquor, and also, the evidence suggests, sex, that they were actually places where the men doing the mining could find female company.
And that was, in part, one of the Trump businesses?
That was one of the earliest Trump businesses. And the interesting thing about Friedrich Trump is that he always made his money by situating his businesses where other people were doing something else. So when he was in Washington State, he also was in the hospitality business, also making money by being well situated next to the depot where workers were coming in and out. Same thing in Alaska. He always situated his restaurants in places where he would get a heavy foot traffic. So location, location, location was the way he made his business. But it was also a sort of an insurance policy because the other people were losing money from the gold rush. Not very many people made money from the gold rush, but Friedrich Trump managed to escape the gold rush with a lot of money and bring it back east, which is how they started the Trump family real estate business.
So he goes from the Yukon to New York.
Right. He goes back from the Yukon to New York, and he has this nest egg of money. And what is really interesting is when he arrives in the United States, it's the Gilded Age. And it is a situation of income inequality similar to our own. There are very, very, very rich people. There are very poor people. And the gap is widening. But the interesting thing about this era is that in America at that time, there was still so much land and so much immigration that people could change their social class. And that's what Friedrich Trump was able to do.
So he brings his money to New York and gets into the real estate business. Why did he get into real estate?
Well, it was another situation of looking at what was happening with the local infrastructure. And he decided to set up business in Queens, New York, which at that time did not have a direct route from Manhattan. If you wanted to come by land, you had to come over the Brooklyn Bridge and then upward into Queens, or there were ferry boats. But they were building a bridge at that time. And right before that is when he started to buy land. And of course, government infrastructure projects always boost real estate. And it's one of the constant themes that you see with the Trump family and the Kushner family, that these big government-funded infrastructure projects create the customer base for their business. So that's what happened. That is how the Trump real estate business began to be successful in those early days.
So Friedrich Trump, Donald Trump's grandfather, dies in 1918, a victim of the influenza epidemic. And then his son gets into real estate. How old was Frederick, which is Donald Trump's father? How old was he when his father, Friedrich, died?
So Frederick or Fred.
So let's just stop here and say we'll call Trump's grandfather Friedrich and we'll call Trump's father Fred.
Fred Trump is how he is known in New York City. And of course, there's a lot of people here who still remember Fred Trump. But at the time his father died, he was still a teenager. And his mother was very business-minded, and she set up a business called E. Trump & Son. And they started to build houses, but sort of one by one. So they would build a house and sell it and take the money and build another house. He also, at one point, got into the grocery business. And he was doing this for a while. And then, of course, along comes the Great Depression, and it's a terrible time for real estate in New York and everywhere. People are losing money all over the place because of foreclosures. So Fred Trump goes into the grocery business, and he might have stayed there, but he figured something out.
What did he figure out?
He figured out how to work political connections to get court assignments that would enable him to make money. So in the mid-1930s, he goes into a Brooklyn courtroom with very little real estate experience, just what I talked about, building houses and selling them one by one until he actually got out of the business because of the Depression. And he goes in and he says, I've been in real estate for 10 years, and makes an argument for why he should get an assignment from a judge to take over a piece of a bankrupt company. But he realizes along the way that to get the judge's attention, the judges are controlled by the Brooklyn political machine. And to get the judge's attention, he needs to become close to the Brooklyn political machine. And this is what he does. And it is a lifelong practice for Fred Trump, and then later for Donald Trump, that they cultivate their connections with the Brooklyn political machine, which at that time was almost exclusively controlled by the Democratic Party. So Fred Trump becomes one of the largest donors to the Democratic Party. He becomes very, very close to a Democratic political club called the Madison Club, and they controlled everything. And that was one way that Fred Trump learned early on to wield his political power so there would always be government favor for his business in whatever way he needed.
So you're suggesting that the Trump family became political donors and Democratic donors, not because of political views that they held, but because those were the people in power and they were trying to buy into the power.
They realized that it was a necessity for their business. And Fred Trump really got two big breaks that launched the Trump real estate empire. One was in the Brooklyn courtroom, where he got the assignment for a piece of a company being distributed in bankruptcy court. And the second was because he made friends with the local federal housing administrator. And this local housing administrator threw him lots and lots and lots of federal money. And in fact, at one point, he was called before the Senate Banking Committee and required to answer for how much business he'd been given, what a huge percentage of business he'd been given, and the numbers that were underlying his loan applications. And the senators were very suspicious, and they said to him, you are valuing things highly when you want money from us and valuing them lowly when you want to avoid taxes. But even though the Senate Banking Committee investigated Fred Trump for this, they sort of wrapped him on the wrist and sent him on his way, and there were no consequences. And we know now that he kept doing exactly that.
So we can see from the roots of the Trump family business that the Trump family business profited greatly from government help.
They could not have been what they are without the help of the taxpayers in a whole variety of ways, through infrastructure programs, through tax abatement programs, which allowed them to avoid paying taxes in certain instances. And they also benefited by what the New York Times called outright fraud. They just simply didn't pay the taxes they were supposed to. So they were in this position of getting help from the government and getting help from government programs, and at the same time, actively trying not to pay money back to the taxpayers.
I've heard that, you know, you hear like Trump's family is German, but occasionally you hear something about Sweden. So you explain that. You explain that in your book. And I want you to explain where Sweden figures into the Trump family roots, or does not figure into it, as the case may
there be. There are a lot of outright falsehoods in the Trump family biography and in what Trump says about himself and in what his father said about himself. Fred Trump's father came from Germany, and his mother came from Germany, and they actually spoke German at home. And he, during the war, was building in Virginia, federally subsidized housing. And he didn't want people to know of his German roots, so he said he was Swedish. And this became a theme constantly, that Fred Trump and then later Donald Trump said their roots were Swedish. The most interesting time they said it was at Fred Trump's funeral. The New York Post reported Fred Trump was from Sweden. So that lie traveled with him until the end of his life. And in many of the early profiles of Donald Trump, for example, in the New York Times, they kept saying his ancestors are Swedish. And it was repeated over and over again. But Donald Trump's grandfather and grandmother were definitely from Germany.
Did Donald ever say that his heritage was Swedish?
All the time. He told reporters that. He told people in New York, people really thought he was from Sweden or that his ancestors were from Sweden, but they were not in any way.
So let's talk about Jared Kushner's backstory. His grandparents have pretty remarkable stories about how they survived the Holocaust in Poland. Tell us one of those stories.
So Jared Kushner's grandmother, Ray Kushner, has a remarkable story of survival. She grew up in a family of furriers in a town in what was then northeast Poland. It's now Belarus. And she began hearing stories that the Germans were killing Jews and just didn't believe it. But then the Germans marched in to Novogrudek. And at first things were okay, but then came a very cold December day where thousands of Jews were rounded up in a courthouse and told, you go to the right, you go to the left, and one way was to live, and one way was to die, and the Kushner family was sent to die to board trucks bound for mass graves. But then, before they could board the trucks, they were asked, is anybody here a furrier? And the Kushners said they were, and the Germans pulled them out of the line because they wanted them to make hats and coats for the German army. And this is what they did. They basically lived inside a ghetto, had very little to eat, and had to work as enslaved people for the Nazis. And the Nazis kept killing more and more people as they decided they were superfluous. There were a few hundred survivors in the summer of 1943, and they realized they had to escape. And they knew that there was a band of partisan Jews in the forest. And if they could get out there, they had a chance of living. So they began to dig a tunnel. And they had to hide the bags of dirt that they were excavating underneath beds and inside walls so the Nazis wouldn't find them. But they did build this tunnel and crawled out of it. It was 2 feet across. And Ray Kushner and her father, Nam Kushner, and her sister, Lisa, made it out of the tunnel alive and into the forest. Their brother, Hanun, when he got out of the tunnel, became disoriented, ran in the wrong direction, and was ultimately shot by the Nazis.
So that's a really remarkable story of survival. And they managed eventually to get to America, the Kushners, the surviving Kushners.
So Ray Kushner and her husband, Joe, who had his own story of survival during the war, met up after the war and got married in Budapest on the run, took trains and walked and snuck across borders. And this is all by their own account, illegally, until they ended up in a displaced persons camp in Italy, where they were stateless. And they tried to get into any country that they could. They tried to get into South Africa. They tried to get into Israel. They tried to get into the U.S. And no one would take them. And then, as they understood it, and this is by the account of a book that was written for Jared Kushner's grandmother on her 75th birthday, they realized that U.S. immigration law favored sons over son-in-laws. So, of course, they had nothing left. All of their documents had been destroyed by the Nazis. So in their immigration paperwork, Jared Kushner's grandfather said that he was his father-in-law's son. So the family took on the name Kushner. So to just raise into historical relief what happened here, that Jared Kushner's family made it here by doing what they needed to do, and now in the White House, the Trump administration policy is to constrict and constrict and constrict the number of refugees that are allowed into the United States.
The Kushner family did what it needed to do to survive, and they did it, I think, in a really brave and admirable way. You do what you do to stay alive. I think the question is not that they had a lie to get here, but rather, why is it that Jared seems to show so little sympathy or empathy for people who are trying to get to the U.S.? And this isn't, I'm just wondering why, knowing what his family history is.
Every time he's asked about it, he changes his story into a story of family success. And I should say that in the course of writing my book, sent 83 questions to Jared Kushner at the White House. Some of them were answered. This one was not. And the question was, is there any contradiction between your family history and the current administration policy? Other journalists have asked him about it, and he has just resisted. He has said, it doesn't really matter because there's 65 million refugees and we can't possibly take them all. So we have a rational policy. That is the answer that he's given. I mean, I think that Jared Kushner, comes from a family that values family loyalty and married into a family that values family loyalty. And he will always be loyal to his father-in-law, unless there was some kind of radical break. So that is as simple to him as breathing, is defending his father-in-law's policies, whatever they may be.
I don't know if you'll have anything to say about this, but knowing as much about Donald Trump, his businesses, his administration, do you have any insights to share about why he might have chosen to take out Soleimani and bring us to the brink of war with Iran?
Let me say this. When Trump ran his business, there was only one decision maker, and that was Donald Trump. And he just did what he wanted, and he did it also impulsively. This is clearly the way he runs the country as well. He doesn't necessarily read evidence. He doesn't take advice. He makes decisions, and he acts on them. And he acts aggressively. I think that this is connected to what the New York real estate community always tells me about him. He's not one of us. He just goes his own way. But he is so skilled at the art of compromise and of drawing people into his circle of influence that he has created a situation in the White House where no one can object. We haven't really talked about Michael Cohen, but I'll just throw in a quick anecdote about Michael Cohen. When Michael Cohen was testifying before the House Oversight Committee, he said to them, Donald Trump kept making me feel like I was important. It was a thrill to work for him. And I kept crossing lines. And each time I crossed a line, it was harder to say no to the next line. And he said very directly to Congress, don't do this. I could be you. I was where you are. But I think that's what we've seen in the White House, that Trump creates a situation where people around him do not say no and are willing to go with him wherever he goes. And now we are at the situation where he has created this very tense diplomatic and foreign relations crisis.
There's so many reporters who have been documenting evidence of breaking laws, corruption, falsehoods connected to Donald Trump. You alone have covered so many stories relating to, you know, various misrepresentations of the truth, corruption, breaking of the law, and yet it keeps going. So why do you think it is that there's been so little accountability?
One of the things that the Trump family has always understood is that part of their business success needs to be making sure that no law enforcement agent or district attorney or prosecutor is going to blow the whistle. And they've done this in a variety of ways. They've done it by supporting the electoral machines that support them. They've done it by making donations to charities of district attorneys. They've done it when their lawyers make donations to the district attorneys. And in cases, Donald Trump has just charmed FBI agents. He's invited them to play golf and ride in his helicopter and have lunch with him at the 21 Club. And he has managed, through money and charm, to keep law enforcement at bay. And he has never been called to account. And what we find is that each time he is not called to account, he feels more powerful to go even further the next time. We see this exact pattern with Ukraine. Mueller report does not lead to an impeachment. The day after Mueller testifies, he calls the president of Ukraine and asks him to interfere in the 2020 election. So what is at balance in this upcoming impeachment trial? This is the final way to call Donald Trump to account. If he is not called to account, I think we can only expect what we've seen in the past, which is that he feels even more empowered to break rules, break norms in the way he's been doing.
Andrea Bernstein, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It is so great to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Andrea Bernstein is the author of the new book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. She also co-hosts the podcast, Trump Inc. The new HBO series, The Outsider, based on a suspense novel by Stephen King, stars Ben Mendelsohn and Cynthia Erivo as detectives trying to solve a murder that seems to defy all logic. Our critic at large, John Power, says that this adaptation takes the master of horror's work in an unexpected direction.
If you made a list of the most important figures in pop culture over the last half century, near the top you'd have to put Stephen King. Since publishing his first novel, Carrie, in 1974, the 72-year-old writer has been a literary juggernaut whose books have spawned 26 TV shows and 47 movies. Still going strong, King is best known for exploring and tapping into that most primal of emotions, fear. Fear of madness and menstrual blood, fear of killer clowns and demonic pets, fear of addiction and entrapment. Such fear takes the form of a slow-building dread in The Outsider, the new 10-part HBO series based on King's 2018 novel of the same title. Though this adaptation is probably too well-heeled for its pulpy material, the show has a terrific plot hook. And once I made peace with its moody rhythms, I found myself hooked. I devoured the 6 hours available for preview in 2 nights. The Outsider begins when the body of a murdered and sexually assaulted 11-year-old boy is found in the Georgia woods. The investigation is led by righteously angry police detective Ralph Anderson, who's mourning the recent death of his own teenage son. Ralph is played by grizzled Ben Mendelsohn, who my women friends tell me is a sex symbol, though I've merely thought of him as one of those superb Australian actors that Hollywood now prefers to their grizzled American counterparts. The evidence quickly leads Ralph to arrest Terry Maitland. That's Jason Bateman, a beloved local schoolteacher who coached Ralph's son in Little League. The case against him seems open and shut. Witnesses put Terry at the scene. Video footage confirms it, as do the DNA samples. There's just one problem, a huge one. Other witnesses, backed by video footage, put Terry in a full room in another city at the time of the murder. Ralph begins to have doubts, and here he expresses them to the ambitious local DA, who wants to nail Terry to boost his own career.
If Terry Maitland is innocent...
Which he's not.
If he is, we're not done. This happens again? How badly do you want to win, Kenneth?
I don't know, Ralph. How badly do you want to lose?
Faced with a baffling enigma, Ralph enlists the help of a private eye, Holly Gibney, a spectrumy savant of astonishing mental gifts. She's exceedingly well played by British musician and actress Cynthia Erivo, who recently starred in the Harriet Tubman biopic. As Holly pursues leads to other cities and crimes, things get spookier and spookier. Although The Outsider is no masterwork in a TV era when we expect them, it is a finely tooled series, with the trademark HBO luster, sharply elegant scripts by Richard Price and Dennis Lehane, and excellent performances, including Julian Nicholson as Terry's wife, Glory, who's furious at what's happening to her husband, Mare Winningham as Ralph's sensible wife, Jeannie, still shell-shocked by the death of their son, and Derek Cecil as a good-hearted ex-cop who is smitten by Holly, a socially maladroit woman other men just find weird. Bateman directed the first two episodes, and he lays down a slow, surprisingly mournful template. Where most thrillers and horror tales don't claim to be more than good, trashy fun, The Outsider takes its story seriously. So seriously, in fact, that some viewers may find it pretentious or exasperating. Me, I thought this approach made an interesting change. Rather than amp things up to make us shriek, the series slowly fuels our anxiety by taking time to make us care about the characters. Despite its lack of visual ambition, the show works similar terrain to the recent run of art horror movies like Suspiria, Midsommar, and The Lighthouse, all of which care less about making the audience scream in terror than about exploring what underlies the terror. Without giving anything away, I can tell you that The Outsider deals with grief and the horrors unleashed by grieving, as well as the fear of contamination by uncontrollable forces, a fear that influences everything from our immigration policy to the way supermarkets put hand sanitizer by their doors. In the process, The Outsider captures the quality that has always given King's work its seductive power. It draws the connection between our inner demons and the ones roaming out in the world.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large. He reviewed the new HBO series The Outsider, based on a suspense novel by Stephen King.